Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with the historian of this great place, Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee, and you can join in. In fact, if you're very quick, I see a line that's not ringing yet. 317-239-1070 is our telephone number. A reminder, if you send in an email question, I'm collecting those. I've got a special file I can move those over to, and we're going to have email-only shows Tuesday and Thursday of next week. So kind of your deadline is going to be, say Monday afternoon for that. And we're going to have a special treat. They're going to hold a special practice while we record those shows, and we'll put the car noises in the background of us here on Monday afternoon. So I always look forward to that as well. Nice day today at the Speedway, much more comfortable than yesterday as far as the wind was concerned. It was warm, and it was busy with Jay Howard being the fastest at over 226. Well, let's get into it and find out what the people want to know tonight. We start with Brian. Hi, Brian. You're on with Donald.
Hi, Brian.
Thank you, guys. Love the show. 45 minutes is just not enough when I listen to it on the podcast. Anyway, the other night you were talking about drivers that were started last in the field, and it got me to thinking about what used to be the first alternate. I think you even referenced it. And I wondered, when was the last time their first alternate was actually started the race, and how many times was it actually used?
Okay, that's a good question. The last time, I got to think, because there was a situation in 1997 where 35 cars were allowed to start. I know now they do not name a first alternate, even if they had one. They now do not have a provision. It was decided that because of the rules now, with not only are driver switches permitted, but car switches permitted in certain circumstances, that the likelihood of a team not being able to run and somebody else coming in is probably not going to happen. So I think the last time with a 33-car field that it happened was 1986, when there was a multiple accident on during Corporation Day, and several cars could not be repaired. And the drivers were allowed to go to backup cars because there was a backup entered. Dennis Firestone, and that would include Roberto Moreno, George Snyder, and Joseli Garcia, I think. Roberto Moreno should never paint myself into this corner.
I won't be able to help you without looking it up.
Well, yeah, but you're looking it up.
No, I said I won't be able to help you unless
I look it up.
Oh, you won't
be able to. Okay. Anyway, Dennis Firestone had to be able to repair the car because they did not have a backup entry. That was the ruling. It was a one-car entry. And because he could not repair the car, and they tried diligently to do it, at some point they had to give up. And then Dick Simon, who had been bumped and was the first alternate starter, then came back into the field. The time that had happened before that was 1984, just 2 years before that. And that was a slightly different situation. Chris Neifel, who was from quite a well-to-do family and had actually been in the race the year before, qualified and was bumped and was the first alternate starter. And then in time, Jacques Villeneuve, the uncle of the Jacques that won it in 1995, Uncle Jacques had qualified a car, was out in a backup in anticipation that he might be bumped, and he crashed the backup car, and had a, I think he had a concussion. Anyway, he medically, physically, was not going to be permitted to run. And so then I heard that the car was being withdrawn and that Chris Neifel was going to come into the field. And I went down to see the team manager in trying to help and said, you know, you don't need to do that because the car has qualified, the car can run, and you can substitute another driver. And he said, thank you. We're very familiar with the rules of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I thought, well, all right then, mate, you figure it out. Well, so just try to help. And so anyway, it turns out that the reason for the withdrawal was, and that I think there were some financial considerations given, and so it was decided that rather than put another driver in it, they would actually pull the entry out, which would then reinsert the last car to be bumped, which was Chris Neifel. So that's why Neifel was able to start in 84. There were a number of years where, well, actually, there were occasions in the 20s and 30s when occasionally when a car would be withdrawn and somebody else would come in. Although a lot of the times in the 20s, they did not even have a full field. In fact, like, for instance, in 1928, they had, let's see, hang on just a sec, painting myself into another corner. I know they had three cars that qualified and couldn't start, but they withdrew one. They had a short field to begin with, and I think they started 28 cars. Is that right? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Anyway, then in 1937, they had a situation involving they started 29. That was it. They started 29 in 1928. They'd actually had 32 qualifiers, and there were three cars Buddy Marr's car was crashed by Chet Miller, and then on race morning, they had a warm-up session, and the track was damped, and Dutch Bowman and Laura Corum both crashed on race morning and couldn't start. So they ended up with 29 starters. Anyway, in 1937, the infamous Joel Thorne had a several-car entry and drove one himself, and he qualified, and he was bumped. He was the first alternate starter. And he went around to he made an arrangement with a team. It was owned by George Lyons. Cliff Brazier was the driver. And he said to them, what do you think are your chances? And they said, well, we don't think we can win with this. And apparently they suggested that they would probably finish fifth, Cliff Brazier. And so Thorne said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will pay you for fifth place prize money and buy the race car from you. And they said, okay. And so word got back to the AAA officials that this Joel Thorne, who hasn't driven in a race yet, but he would eventually drive in four, Joel Thorne is planning to withdraw this car, not substitute himself as driver, but he's going to withdraw it so that he can come in as the he was the second alternate. That was it. He was the second alternate starter. And then a car that was qualified by Emil Andres as the first alternate, Thorne went and purchased that car and withdrew it. So that moved him from the second alternate to the first alternate. Then he went and made the deal with George Lyons and Cliff Brazier with a view to withdrawing that so he would come in. Well, in the meantime, AAA got the sanctioning body got word of it, and they called Thorne in. And they told him, look, you can't do that. And he said, well, of course I can. I can go and buy whatever I want. And so they said, well, you know, we're not going to allow you to do that. He said, well, supposing I go out and buy the entire field and withdraw them all, then what are you going to do? And so he wasn't the easiest person to get along with. So anyway, they talked about it, and he left in a huff. And then they gathered around and thought, you know what? We better go around and talk to some of the car owners and tell them not to make a deal with Thorne. And so they went around, and Thorne never had any money. I mean, it was always promise, and he was wealthy, but he didn't have, he never had ready cash. And so it was all on promise. And so they ran around to talk to some of the teams and found out that he'd made deals, verbal deals with like half the field. So they called him back in and said, look, would you like to drive in the Indianapolis 500 someday? then I suggest you cut this out right now. Why don't you stop it right now, and then you can come back next year and do it properly. Because if you don't, you know, you may get a lifetime suspension for conduct detrimental to racing, and you'll never get a chance. So he agreed to that. And so all the deals were off. Cliff Brashear went ahead and finished fifth. Well, after that, and for the next many years, their attitude was, when qualifying is over and you've got your 33, that's the field. And if anybody can't start, they'll get 33rd. And so in 1941, Sam Hanks, who had qualified for his second 500, had a crash in what we still call carburation runs the day before, major crash. And so he's down in Methodist Hospital on race day, but he gets 33rd position. And it's a little difficult there to decide, did Sam have 12 or 13 starts? Mm. Did he have a 13th start? Well, he was in Methodist Hospital for 24 hours before the race started. Anyway, on the morning of the 41 race, there was a fire in the garage area, and the car qualified by George Barringer had to be withdrawn. And so because it was withdrawn later, it got 32nd. And so they actually started the race with 31. And then in 1949, Spider Webb had a transmission failure discovered on the morning of the race at a couple of hours before the start. They realized, we can't start. And so he was given 33rd and didn't even push off. So then, apparently, the decision was made for 1950 that they would now allow alternates. And the late Blaycock, who ran the press room here for years and had the title of Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian, said that his one of his first jobs, when he was just helping out with the press department, one of his jobs was to stand down at the south end with Cliff Griffith in the Tom Serafoff special and George Fonder with the Ray Brady special. They were the first and second alternates. And they were sitting down there with the engines running, and his job was to make sure that everybody pushed off. Because in those days, they only went around once. They didn't have the parade lap and so on and so forth. The pace car, up through 1956, the pace car would leave with the field, and it would come in at the end of the next lap. So they never went by with the people waving, with the drivers waving. The next time you saw the pace car after it left with the field was it coming in. So anyway, Bob, his job was to stand down there with George, with Cliff Griffith and George Fonda with the motors running, and then they weren't needed. So I know in 1956, Eddie Sachs was in the, not at the south end, but actually in the gasoline alley, the gate coming out into the pits, actually was there with his Ray Brady special as the 34th fastest qualifier, that if any of the cars couldn't start, then he would be pushed out. So that rule, I don't know how long that was in, but it was never implemented. And then I know that Harlan Fengler, his attitude for a number of years was that we won't put an alternate in after a certain point. On race morning, if somebody can't fire up, they're 33rd.
Yeah. Interesting. So, thank you for the call, Brian. So as I'm looking at the box scores of these races that you're discussing, the 1941 race where two did not start, who finished last among those that started?
Joel Thorne was 31st.
Who you just talked about. He finished 30 and completed four laps in that race. And then skimming through, I also found it interesting. You mentioned the race in 27, I think you said.
28.
28, we were looking for the numbers, and it was 29 starters, 33 the next year, then 38, then 40, then 40, then 42 in 1933. Okay. Is that the largest field?
Yes. Yeah. The explanation for that is that when they were going into the Depression, they decided to increase the size of the starting field from 33 to 40. And in 1930, there's only 38 because they only had 38 met the qualification requirements. And then in 1931 and 1932, they had 40 starters. But because that meant 13 rows of three plus one, they had a ton of entries, they said, let's just fill out the last row. So that's why in 1933, there's 42 starters.
It paid $200 to finish 42nd in the 1935.
Louis Schneider, who'd won the race in 1931, is the only person that could say,
there you go,
I finished 42nd in the Indianapolis 500.
All right, more questions for Donald on the Talk of Gasoline Alley coming up on 107.5 1070 The Fan. Back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee, and you, full phone lines for the moment, but Dave was able to sneak his way in and has a question for Donald now. Hi, Dave.
Hi there, Donald.
Dave!
Is this Dave from Marion?
Yeah, we were concerned about, I think you had a birthday, what was it, 2 days ago?
yesterday, actually.
Oh, happy birthday for yesterday. Okay, well we're great. You. A lot of people have been asking about you.
I was at practice Monday and yesterday both, so good place to spend your birthday. Good. Would you talk about Don Freeland?
Yes, sure, I'd love to. Don Freeland was one of those, I suppose you'd call him an underrated driver. He was not a flashy type at all. And his tenure, actually, well, from 1953 to 1963 was the period in which he tried to qualify. But his last start was 1960. And so in 53, he drove for Bob Estes, and actually he'd been back the year before. I think he was on the crew. He was an A.J. Watson crony. He was one of the people that came out of the Roaring Roadsters, plus 500 Roadsters, but Hot Rods on the West Coast. One of a number of drivers that came along in the late 40s and early 50s out of that discipline. And so he's a friend of A.J. Watson and Jed Phillips. And I think when Jim Rigsby finished 12th for Bob Estes in 1952 with A.J. Watson and Jed Phillips as co-chiefs, I think Don Freeland was on that crew. Well, anyway, he started driving sprint cars for Bob Estes and then drove in the 500 1953, well, he drove for Estes in 53, 54, 55, and 56. In 53, he was 27th. He spun out, went down through went into the first turn, and actually went down through the creek, and which is on film, and that with the brutally hot year of 1953, and the narration on the 60mm film, I think it says, well, that's one way to cool off or something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, I've seen that.
in 1954, he finished seventh and earned his way into the champion 100-mile-an-hour club. In 1955, he was one of several drivers that ran second behind Bob Swigert and didn't finish. And he was running second at, let's see, about 170 laps, I think, and then had a transmission problem and just dropped out like in the last 20 laps or so while running second. In 1956, he finished third, and he led a couple of laps in 55 and 56, but those would have been pit stop shuffles, if you like. I mean, he never went up to actually take the lead, but he did lead. So he ended up third behind Pat Flaherty and Sam Hanks. There's a little irony there on a couple of ways that, first of all, Pat Flaherty, well, let's go back to lap 20. Sam Hanks was involved in a spin. It was a multi car accident. No injuries, but several cars were spinning around in all kinds of different directions. Troy Ruttman, Sam Hanks, and a driver named Keith Andrews, and Sam went spinning down into the first turn and out of the view of his pit crew, headed up by George Salley. So they thought, he needs help. So they set off down towards the first turn and taking a jack with them and everything, thinking that Sam would need help. And in the meantime, Sam had kept the engine running and came around on the rim into the pit, only to find that no crew members were there. And Judd Phillips' team, that was the Bob Estes crew and Don Freeland driver, they ran out and changed Sam's tire and sent it back on his way. And that's the car that beat them and finished second, with Don Freeland finishing third. So they were beaten by the car that they'd helped. And then the other thing was that Pat Flaherty took the checkered flag, and then instead of taking the traditional two more laps to make sure that he had 200 in, he came in after the end of the next lap, went straight to victory lane, and the throttle linkage had broken. So if that had happened a lap earlier, and Judd Phillips' crew would not have been so sporting to change Sam Hanks' wheel, Don Freeland could have won the 56 500. Anyway, for whatever reason, he left Bob Estes, and the next year drove for Anstead, the Anstead Rotary Special, Bill Anstead, to take the place of Pat O'Connor, who'd driven for them in 55 and 56. And that seemed like a good move, but he didn't have much of a day. He was running at the end of the race, but he was back in 17th place. So 1950, Bob Estes, and finished seventh again. And then in 1959, drove the Jim Robbins Special, did not finish, was 22nd. In 1960, ran fifth for a while and dropped out with one of my favorite car names, the Ross Babcock Traveler Special, and dropped out and was 22nd in that one. That was his last start. In 61, he drove for Chapman, H.A. Chapman, and made an incomplete attempt, had a wall banger at some point during practice, and ended up jumping cars at the last minute, and took out the Joe Hunt Magneto Special, ran it to completion and wasn't fast enough to get in. In 62, he was back with the Hart Fullerton Special with Ray Gardner, chief mechanic, brother of the late Chet Gardner, who had been a driver in the 1930s, and that one qualified and got bumped. And then in 63, his final attempt with another one of my favorite, White Spot Coffee Shop Special. Wow. and waved off and didn't make it. And then he did not come back again. He never won a championship race, but he was a championship regular, had the one lap track record at Langhorne at one time. And so was a very steady finisher. Member of the Champion 100 Mile an Hour Club, one of the drivers that would go around and do lectures. And that was a very, very popular program where Roger Ward and Jimmy Daywalt and Jack Turner and Chuck Stevenson and Fred Agabasian and Dwayne Carter and Bob Harkey and others would go to school and talk to the students, Gene Hartley. And so Don Freeland was one of those that did that for several years. I never got to meet Don Freeland. 63 was the last year that he tried to drive. My first year was 64, and he didn't come back for years. And then one year, somebody said, Don Freeland's back here. And I chased him around all over the place, and everywhere I went, they said, oh, yes, he was here. He left a few minutes ago. So I never did get to meet him. But anyway, golly, what else can I say about him? A good sprint car driver, but he only ran sprints for a short time. But anyway, one of those good guys, one of my heroes from the 1950s. So, He was involved in
that 53 Hoosier 100.
Oh yes, exactly. Okay, yes. Yes, he finished third in that. It was Bob Schweikert won it in the Dean Van Line special. There was four cars that came over nose to tail, and I think the first five were with like 2 or 3 seconds, and they just ran nose to tail for much of the race. And Bob Schweikert won it for Dean Van Lines. Manny Aiello was second for Peter Schmidt. And then, let's see, was Johnny Parsons third and Don Freeland fourth, or was it the other way around?
I think Don Freeland was third.
Yeah.
But, thank you, Donald.
All right. Thanks, Dave, and thanks for calling in. We're glad you're okay, and happy birthday from yesterday.
We can relieve the search party now.
Yeah.
They have been searching for days, so it's great to hear from you, and more for Donald coming up in just a moment on the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Back to the phones in just a moment. Quick question from Jennifer, though. They had, her and her husband had the chance to meet with Eldon Rasmussen a couple of days ago, and one of the things they talked about was him working with the 1970 Johnny Lightning special. Just wanted some stories, and if you know anything about
his efforts
with 1970 or anything else on Eldon.
We profiled Eldon, a few nights ago. I didn't know he worked on the Johnny Lightning cars, but I wouldn't be surprised because he did a lot of fabrication on other cars. And I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but in 1975, there were two cars known as Rass cars, and Larry McCoy drove the other one. And those were cars that were actually built by Eldon, with help, of course, but fabricated in his shop. Back in the days when, two or three people could build a car without a computer. So, we talked about it. And while we're just taking a moment here, just a shout out to Jimmy McAreath, who passed away today. And I know you fellows talked about him, and I had to do a quick obit. And I got all kinds of memories of Jimmy. And he actually preferred Jimmy over Jim.
Really?
Yes. Although he appears as Jim in all the books. But in 1964, and I'm going to stop talking about this because I'm really dating myself now. But 1964, my first year after the race was over, and Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald had lost that day, they lost their life that day. To a party at A.J. Watson's house, which is just a very short distance from where we are right now. And it was okay. It was a little bit subdued. And so the party wound down. And then I was taken to another party out very close to your neighborhood in Farley. And I don't know exactly where you were raised, but pretty close to Ben Davis, I think.
Yeah, that's a half a mile from where I live.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was in Farley, and John Locks was the fellow, and so we had a party at his house. There was a bunch of people there, and so then when it was time to get me home, the people that had taken me were going in another direction, and so it ended up that I was driven back to my digs up on Redbird Drive, I was living with a family up. Right by turn three. I mean, I'd get up and look out the window, and the grandstands were right there. Anyway, I was driven home the night of the 64 race by Jimmy McAreath, who'd driven a Novi that day and had not finished. So I did. I have a lot of very fond memories of it was a different time. He came up the hard way, came up through the dirt tracks, and he was a bricklayer. Can you believe that? Mm. And actually, his hod was never far away in the early days. And when he was still driving sprints and even in his early days of driving in the 500, his heart was never far away so that he could actually be a practicing bricklayer. And I don't think we've got any of those. If you look at the media guide this year, I don't think we've got any bricklayers in the 500 this year.
You know, Ed Carpenter is pretty good with his hands, and he builds a lot of things at home. So he's probably the closest we have to it. I know he's built some things at the house, and he will. He's a handyman.
I heard he was a handyman, and I thought, what a great name for a handyman.
There
you go.
Jim McAree certainly will be missed. Passed away today at the age of 89. Let's sneak in a call in this segment. And Mark is with us on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for taking my call and giving me the opportunity to say good evening to Donald.
How are you,
Donald,
sir?
I couldn't be any better. So the only 500 I've ever attended live was in 93, and I want to learn the truth. Did Nelson Piquet actually have a mechanical failure, or did he just step out of the car? And through the history of the 500, are there any other mysterious phantom mechanical failures that have taken a driver out?
I know of one. I'm not aware that Piquet did that. I know that he was a fairly early out. He finished 32nd. I don't know what the lap count was. And as we had mentioned, and not to mean this in a derogatory way, but the fact that he had made such an impact the first year and then had the accident, I think a lot of people, when he came back in 93, there was no fanfare at all.
Sure, it was first time here. Yeah, the year before was the big hoopla.
Absolutely. Yeah. So he drove in the race, and I think a lot of people didn't even remember that he came back and drove in the race. So as far as did he step out with nothing wrong with the car, I'd never heard that before, so I wouldn't say no. But I know that apparently Roger Ward did that in 1966, and that had he stayed in, he probably could have won the race because he came in twice and complained of handling problems. And I know that he was pretty disgruntled. And I had an opportunity in later years to talk with Roger quite a bit about that. And I know that he wasn't very happy. He drove for Meekum. He left Leader Cars after years. And he was the first driver to go to the Meekum team. And he drove a couple of races, and they didn't have much to show for it. George Bignotti had gone as the chief mechanic, and so they ran a few races in 65. He had a good run at Phoenix but didn't finish. Well, anyway, during the winter during the fall and the winter, the team came together, and it was supposed to be John Surtees and Walt Hansken were to be Roger's teammates. And John Surtees was injured in a sports car race in Canada and then was replaced by Jackie Stewart. And that happened fairly early on. I mean, that was probably, I think, even before the turn of the year, it was already that Jackie Stewart was going to be in there instead of Surtees. And then Walt Hansken was fatally injured at Le Mans on April the 24th of 66 in a test, and was replaced by Graham Hill, except that the replacement came so late. The program had already gone to press. And so Walt Hansken's name was removed from the entry list. And so if you get the 66 program, Graham Hill's not in there because his assignment came after the program had gone to press. But so anyway, Roger now is faced with teammates Jackie Stewart and Graham Hill. And for some reason, they were given V8 Fords, and Roger was given a supercharged Offenhauser. And he said, I started to think, what's going on here? It seems like they're getting all of the attention, and I'm just getting this sort of this engine, this experiment. It wasn't even a turbo Offie. It was a supercharged Offie. And he said, I thought I was the number one driver. And he said, I had won the 500 twice, and these two fellows hadn't had a start between them. So I thought that here, I thought I was the number one driver. So he said, so I was getting a little bit disgruntled. And he said, we'd had the Sachs McDonald accident 2 years before. He said, we're coming down for the start. There's a crash. There's cars all over the place. He said, I'm not involved, but I'm seeing all this going on. And he said, we waited for an hour or so, and then we restarted. And he said, the race is wearing on. And he said, I had two little kids at that time. Because he had two boys that were now, oh, golly, was David even a teenager yet? I know there was Roger Jr. and David. And I think Roger Jr. might have been like 22 and David was 19 or 20 or something like that. But now he had two little kids, like two and one or something like that, because I know he had two babies in 64 and 65. And so he said, I'm sitting out there driving along, and he said, I started to get images of my kids. And I thought to myself, Roger Ward, you're too old to be doing this. And he said, I was mad at Bignotti, and I was mad at everything. And he said, I just came in and parked it. And so I know Phil Hedback, Brian Heating and Cooling, was furious. And Skitch Henderson, who was the musical director for The Tonight Show, and way before Doc Severinsen, and he was here. And said, oh, this is a great moment. You know, we're witnessing this great driver retiring from the race. And Phil Hedback didn't think it was a great moment. So as it turned out, who knew? Cars kept dropping out and problems ensued. And had Roger stayed in, he probably could have won the race or at least finished in the top three. So, but out of respect for him, I mean, they could have put another driver in it, but apparently out of respect for him, they just said, okay, roll it away. So there's an example of where the driver quit, and apparently there was nothing wrong with the car. That's the one that I do know about.
And there have been many of those over the years where normally it's just said to be handling, but drivers, you know, just in the 15 years that I've been doing this full-time, it happens a few times a year in a race, not necessarily the 500, where a driver just realizes, I can do nothing other than put the thing in the fence if I stay out here, so they park it.
I do have one. Al Unser, who normally wouldn't quit, and I thought, you know, what a principal fellow that Al Unser was, because in 1990, he drove one of the Alfa Romeos, and it was running at the back of the pack. It was down on power, and he stayed with it the whole race and finished in 13th, and I think a lot of people would have quit. But in 1986... he drove the first of the Ilmor engines before it became the Chevy Indy V8. It was the Ilmor in 86. And he actually parked at some point. It was very unusual for a Penske car to drop out. And I said, and he told me one time, he said, I parked it. He said, that thing was an ill-handling beast. He said, and I said, well, but you know, there were other cars that didn't handle well that you hung with. He said, that thing was trying to kill me. So I brought it in and parked it.
Thanks for the question. More with Donald coming up on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald Davidson and a follow-up, some more tidbits on Roger Ward.
I just thought during the commercial that the following at the Victory Banquet, and I don't know how many people knew this was coming, but I didn't. Roger got up to accept for 15th place, and then he thanked the sponsors and the usual thing. And then he went up and he said, I always told myself, if racing ceased to be fun, I'd quit. Well, yesterday, it just wasn't fun anymore. Hmm. So, see ya. And he was crying as he wound up. I mean, his voice was cracking on the last couple of syllables. So that was about as dramatic as anything I think I ever witnessed.
Let's sneak in Dave real quick. Hi, Dave. You're up with Donald.
Hi, Dave.
Good evening, gentlemen. How you doing? Donald,
very good.
Could you profile Billy Arnold? And perhaps I think in later life, he became a pretty successful businessman.
He did. I hate to do this one in a quickie. Billy Arnold was from Chicago, 5720 Wentworth Avenue, as a matter of fact, which is now, when you're going north on the freeway and you get to 50, between 58th and 57th Street, you've actually gone underneath where the house was. The freeway goes right through it. Anyway, Billy Arnold had five starts. He drove for Mike Boyle in 28 and 29 and finished seventh in 28 with Bill Spence as a relief driver, and then eighth in 29 with Fred Roberts and Cliff Woodbury as a relief driver. But then 30, 31, and 32 was extraordinary. He drove for Harry Hertz. And actually, there's quite a bit to this story, but the short version is that after Harry Hertz, who was trying to make a comeback, realized that he wasn't going to be able to do it, he turned the car over on the first day after making an incomplete qualifying attempt. Billy Arnold won the pole. That's the only time that a car has won the pole after there'd been a wave off with another driver in the same car earlier in the day. Anyway, he started on the pole. Louis Meyer led the first two laps. Billy Arnold took over on the third lap and led the rest of the way. And he was about five and a half laps ahead when he took the checker. Shorty Cantlin finished second, but it was like about 7.5 minutes later. So Billy Arnold led the last 198 laps of the race. In 31, he won the pole again, but his run was disallowed. And he had to, because of a technical situation, he had to come back and qualify on the second day. So he started 18th. Although he ran even faster than he did when he had won the pole that ended up not counting, it took him seven laps to get from 18th to first. Oh. And he wasn't headed until he crashed on the 162nd lap. So I think he led like 155 laps in a row there. This time he got injured. Came back in 32. Lou Moore won the pole. Billy Arnold qualified second. And I think... I think Lou Moore led the first couple of laps. Anyway, Billy Arnold, I think, took over on the third lap and was leading when he crashed, I think, at lap 59 or 60 or something like that. A car got wiggly in front of him over in turn two, and he crashed. So, anyway, if you add it all up, and I know we're running out of time here, between 1930 and 32, led for something like 97.9% of all the laps he completed. And even Bill Vukovich Sr. was not quite up there, close. But anyway, he had just got married, and then probably, you know, the injury thing was bothering the wife, so he retired. And yes, he became a very successful businessman. In World War II, he was a lieutenant colonel, headed up a motor pool division. Was stationed in England, and came back and became very successful as a contractor in Oklahoma City. He'd worked for Chrysler Corporation for DeSoto, but then lived his final years in Oklahoma City as a contractor and built like shopping malls and stuff.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the question tonight, Ooh. Dave. Thank you, Donald. That was an impressive hurry-up performance there to get that one in under the wire.
There was a lot more.
Oh, I'm sure there is. We'll try again tomorrow night at 8 o'clock right after Trackside at 7. Thanks to everyone for joining us on the program. We'll see you tomorrow night here on 107.5 and 107.5.